Folks, it's Friday, September the 20th at just past 4 p.m. Pacific time. We have something unusual today for Dreamland, breaking news from Linda Moulton Howe that relates directly and chillingly to the program you are about to listen to. Linda, why don't you tell us what's happening?
Thanks, Whitley. On September 17th, breaking news from Missoula, Montana, included this quote from Vicki Edwards, wildlife biologist with the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department, quote, "People are seeing healthy-looking deer fall over dead. We have found 100 dead white-tailed deer," close quote. And then 3 days later, on Friday, September 20th, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks reported that the number of dead deer in only 3 days had increased to a total of 175, of which 70 died in those 3 days between September 17th and 20th. And deer are still dying. Many people, including wildlife specialists, have seen healthy-looking deer suddenly fall over dead right in front of them. That is why this die-off is a mystery. Today, on September 20th, I talked with Vivica Krauser, information officer at the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Park Office, who confirmed all 175 deer so far have died in a 10-mile region between the western edge of Missoula and Frenchtown in northwestern Montana. She told me that veterinarians who have done necropsies on the deer are reporting fluid around the liver, lungs, and foaming at the mouth, which could be symptoms of what they call epizootic hemorrhagic disease that comes from the bites of little mites and gnats in the late summer or the early fall before the first frost wipes out those insects. But adding to the mystery of so many white-tailed deer dying so suddenly in a short period of time is the fact that hemorrhagic disease viruses are not contagious from one animal to another. Also, the mite disease does not threaten humans. Lab tests on the deer won't be available before the end of September. If anyone in the Missoula area sees dead or sick deer, please call Vicki Edwards. She is the FWP wildlife biologist in Missoula, Montana. And here is her direct line. They want phone calls. Area code 406-542-5500. And the Montana Fish Wildlife website is fwp.mt.gov. Now, 3 weeks before this unusual Montana whitetail die-off, on the morning of August 27th, a few hundred miles south near Las Vegas, New Mexico, 120 elk were found dead in less than a square mile. Carrie Mower, wildlife health specialist for the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, was first on the scene and told reporters that morning, in a nearly quarter century of his fieldwork, he has never seen so many dead elk within such a small area, and apparently all died within 24 hours between August 26th and the morning of August 27th on a private ranch 20 miles north of Las Vegas, New Mexico. He told me in a phone interview, quote, "I have never seen anything like this, and I've talked with other wildlife biologists who have seen large die-offs, and I've not run across anyone yet who has seen anything of this magnitude. It is probably really doubtful that hemorrhagic disease would be the cause, because hemorrhagic disease is infectious, and it would run a course through time before that many animals died, and they would not die in such close proximity to each other," close quote. So far, Kerry Mower has eliminated anthrax, bullets, pesticides, and lightning. He says his lab tests for hemorrhagic disease and other research won't be ready until next week. One highly strange possibility that no one ever discusses is alien viruses from outer space. Next week, I'll have full updates about these deer and elk die-offs and an update on a leaked U.S. government document that describes human deaths by hemorrhaging at the site of a crashed UFO in 1947.
Thank you very much, Linda. We'll be looking forward to that. Linda Moultonhaus website, earthfiles.com. Don't miss a single day of earthfiles.com. New extraordinary information literally every day. The best website of its kind. Next up, a special extended Dreamland with Dr. Bob Wood and Nick Redfern on the subject of alien viruses and a whole lot more. Then, for subscribers, we get into the details of whether or not such a thing could actually be happening. Could the explosion of strange viruses that is literally happening all around us right now have something to do with the UFO presence and close encounter experience? We're going to find out in just a moment. This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world, and this time we're going even farther beyond than usual with Dr. Robert Wood and Nick Redfern, alien viruses. Bob has not been with us on Dreamland before, but you subscribers can and should listen to Nick Redfern's many appearances on the show. He is a wonderful guest. We love him, and we're glad to have both of them here. Just before we start, all of the documents that we'll be discussing today are available on MajesticDocuments.com. That's MajesticDocuments.com. Nick Redfern's website is nickredfern14.blogspot.com. Now, what are we talking about? Alien viruses, crashed UFOs, MJ-12, biowarfare. These two gentlemen have written a breakthrough book. It's incredible, exciting stuff. Did you know that there have been many cases of UFO crashes and government-related UFO activity involving viruses and illness? Did you know there are some incredibly strange things connecting JFK and the assassination to UFO-related things from way back in the late 40s? It's gonna stun you. The whole show is incredible. This is one of the most important UFO books ever to come down the pike. Alien Viruses, Crashed UFOs, MJ-12, and Biowarfare by Dr. Robert Wood and Nick Redfern. And when we get back, we're getting into it. We'll be right back.
Some of the most thrilling, mind-opening interviews ever recorded are in the Dreamland Archive. Open your mind to Sir Lawrence Gardner's brilliant vision of the past. Listen to Russell Targ's phenomenal insights about ESP. Be inspired by Dr. Eben Alexander's stunning near-death experience. Listen to an actual recording from a plane as it was attacked by a gigantic flying disc. Be transported to a new level of inner grace with Whitley Strieber's meditations. Enjoy The Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Secret School, and Superstorm audiobooks, and so much more. The UnknownCountry.com subscriber section. $3.95 a month to $79 for 2 years. As little as 10 cents a day. Priceless.
This is Whitley Strieber. Don't waste another minute. Go to UnknownCountry.com right now and become a subscriber. We need you now, and you need us, because when you do subscribe, you'll be able to listen to Dr. Wood and Nick Redfern talking about alien viruses. Why has the viral picture on planet Earth become so complicated and so strange in recent years? Find out. Subscribe today.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. This is The Edge of the World.
This book, the first of its kind, delves into the many leaked documents that describe research into alien biology and virology. I would like to welcome one of the great experts in this field, Dr. Robert Wood. Bob, before we start, could you tell me a little bit about your own background and tell us about your own background in this? It's so extensive, folks. He knows so very much about this and has such an extraordinary background. Rather than just reading a little bio, I thought I'd let him tell us in his own words how he came to this. It must be, it strikes me as probably an absolutely fascinating story, Bob, and welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you, Whitley. My background is actually divided into two big chunks. The first one occurred in 1966 when I was an upcoming young executive at McDonnell Douglas, and my boss asked me, we got to tell the Air Force how we think we'll go to orbit back 10 years from now. We got any ideas? And so just for a joke, I said, well, why don't we tell them about how the alleged UFOs do it? He said, that's a great idea. Why don't you work on that? And that's when I read my first UFO book.
And, wow.
and then it turned out that I got so interested in the subject that I was asked by higher management people, what would it take for us to look into the subject of how they work? And so we wound up, spending $500,000, the same amount of money the Condon Committee spent in 1968 to 1970 for McDonnell Douglas, trying to figure out how they work. We didn't find out, but it's all written up. Well, so that's the first big chunk of how I got involved. And then I had to work for 23 years on important things like how to defend against ballistic missiles from the Soviets and so forth. But when I retired, my old buddy, Stan Friedman, who actually worked for me on that project, called me up and said, I know you're retired. You don't have anything to do. He said, I got a document that Don Berliner sent me, which looks like it's a manual for describing what to do with alien bodies.
You know, I would like to discuss that very thing first. That was my first question, oddly enough, Bob. But before we go there, I want to bring Nick in and welcome, first of all, to the show, Nick.
Hey, Whitley.
Well, it's good to have you back, folks. We all know Nick Redfern very well, but what we did not know, and I did not know about you, Nick, is the depth that you have actually gone in this kind of research, like the question about the 1965 case in Richmond, North Yorkshire. You really went into that. You actually met the man. Tell us a little bit about that before we start, and then we're going to go back to the document, that extraordinary document.
Okay. Well, this is a very important case, the one you're talking about, Whitley. It dated from, as you said, 1965 in Richmond, which is a little village in North Yorkshire, England, towards the Scottish border. And why it's so important is because the witness, describes seeing what today we would call like a definitive so-called flying triangle type of UFO. And, you know, there's a lot of debate as to whether or not these flying triangles are, quote, ours or theirs, so to speak. But what's interesting is that because there's been sort of a larger sort of proliferation of sightings since the 80s onwards, the prevailing theory is, well, they've got to be military craft of some kind,
right,
which on the surface makes sense. But this particular report, why it's so important, is the fact that the witness described like a fleet of these flying triangles exactly identical to the ones seen today. That's to say they were very large, like 100 foot or so in width and length. They were classic flying triangle shape. They had the low humming noise that many witnesses report. They had like a trio of lights beneath, which witnesses also report today. And also, rather than being purely angular, they had rounded corners. And
which in a moment is going to become very important in our discussion. That's why I asked you to talk about this particular case before we went to the SOM-1-01 document. Go ahead.
Okay, cool. And what was intriguing but also disturbing was that the witness, a man named Jeffrey Brown, who I was able to have a personal conversation with, and that is his real name, I actually found this record, this
now,
document,
folks,
in the official National Archives at the
South
London.
Just listen to this, folks, what he's saying. This is true research. This is the real thing you're hearing. He finds the document, a case in 1965, and when did you look this man up?
This was probably about 12, 13 years ago, something like that.
So, in other words, there were many years that passed, and you found the guy. You went out, and you went to him personally and found him. Now,
and I did an extensive interview with Jeffrey Brown, and he related the whole thing to me about how he saw this strange device, and then he saw like a fleet of them, you know, so many thousands of feet, he presumed, above, and they were all of a very similar design. But what was intriguing and disturbing were two things. One was that although he didn't tell anybody other than the Ministry of Defense, he actually sent a letter in to them. But over the course of about the next year or so, periodically he would get calls, and he didn't know who they were coming from, but asking if any mysterious visitors or characters had come to the house. And it kind of had like MIB-style aspects to it, which kind of perturbed him, as you could probably imagine. But the other thing, which was kind of weird as well and equally disturbing, and which is related to the subject matter of the book about illnesses, was that right after the encounter occurred and for a period of time afterwards, he began to develop these sort of strange rashes and wheals all over his body. And, you know, he didn't think it was like a stress thing. It just seemed to coincide with the close proximity of these craft. Now, of course, it wasn't anything as serious as, like, radiation poisoning, because when I interviewed, it was 40-something years later, and he was, you know, still in good health.
Obviously, he was still in good health, but it must have been frightening to him.
And something right afterwards and briefly sort of severely affected his health and his skin, and he said there was nothing going on unusual in his life at that time beyond the UFO encounter.
Okay, now, Bob, we're going to go to the document, the first, the SOM-1-01 document, and folks, what you heard there was the voice of a real expert researcher. Never let it be said, or never when you hear people sneering and snickering about UFO researchers, some of them are five-star. We have 2 5-star researchers here. Nick's story, that is well researched. Now, Bob, tell us first, before we get into the detail about the triangles, which is so critical here, tell us first about the document itself and how it came into your knowledge.
Well, it was mailed to Don Berliner as a form of a 35-millimeter film. And so I went to Washington, where Don lives, and we went to a private print shop and made...
Mailed by whom?
Well, it was mailed from a drugstore in the West. I forget the name right now.
Yeah, but it's not important. My point is this. Yeah. It was mailed anonymously. And when did this happen precisely?
It was 1994.
Long before any kind of easy or even difficult digital manipulation was possible. Bear all that in mind, folks. Let's go on. Go back to Washington.
So anyway, I got high-quality copies of this document and began the process of trying to figure out whether it was authentic or not. So I went to, it was claimed to be printed by the public printer, so I went to the public printer in Washington.
Can you, before we go into that, go ahead and then afterwards we'll describe what's in the document.
The title of the document is Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology Recovery and Disposal. And it clearly described how the troops or whoever they were to proceed to take care of the parts of crashed saucers and what to do with the bodies and how to handle them and the various levels of secrecy and procedures and how to box them and where to send them. And actually, one of the places to send them was Area 51 S4 on a table. So this was a 1954 document. So anyway, I took the pages of this document into... after I got an appointment with the person who's supposed to deal with the public at the public printer, and said, well, you know, I've got a document here. I wonder if you could tell me about its authenticity. So, you know, this stamped top secret, you know. So he looked at it, and he started to turn the pages, and then he slowed down. It took about 10 minutes before he finally looked up, and he said, well, you know, he said, based on content, I say clearly it's fake. But he said, there's one thing in here that really puzzles me, and he said, and that is that it every so often has a raised Z. And he said, that particular type font is Monotype Modern, and you can tell, and he described the details, and he said, I am satisfied that this was printed with printer. That in those days, what happened was that the Z, a rarely used type font, was not dropping properly, and so every so often it would show up as a raised document. And he said, I believe it was authentically printed.
Of course, he had to say that the contents were fake. Tell us a little bit about the contents.
Well, it's about 22 pages, and it begins by describing what the scope of the program was, and in effect, it reconfirms the original Eisenhower briefing document that there was a program set up in 1947 called Majestic 12, and it's divided into five or six sections, and each section is oriented towards a special purpose. One section, for example, is on deception, to make sure that you keep the public in the dark at all times. One section is on the specifics of how to deal with the parts. And one of the things there is some time markers, because the words that were used were the words of that era. For example, the word screwdriver were two separate words, and since then, why, it's now one word. The word craft tape was capitalized. Now we don't capitalize it. And the words first aid were capitalized, initial caps then, and now they're not. So these are markers that, in effect, independent of the details of the printing process, confirmed that this was that era from 1954.
So it's probably, I mean, your assessment of it, I think, in Stanton's is, too, that it's probably authentic.
Yeah, is just no question about what it was printed in 1954, and if you go down the direction of say, well, maybe the Soviets did it to try to fool us somehow into thinking that psychological warfare thinking does not hold together, because you have to have a target, you have to have an objective, you have to have a plan, and none of that is consistent with the way that we and the Soviets were in that 1954 era. So the most likely case by far is, I'd say, 99% certain that it is a document that describes what we really were doing and what our plans really were for recovery. And the reason we had such a sophisticated recovery system is that long before the 1947 crash, we had some earlier crashes recovered.
Yeah, tell us a little bit. Well, we got to take a break. I hate this. If you're a subscriber, folks, you're not going to have to take a break. But if you're not, and if you're listening to this on Free Dreamland, then listen up to these commercials. And if everybody became a subscriber, then there wouldn't be any more commercials. It would be so lovely. And one of the things we're going to be doing when we do talk to the subscribers is we're going to be talking about viruses and illnesses connected with crash retrievals, close encounters. It's important stuff. We'll be right back.
Unknown Country is the largest edge science website in the world for a good reason. The best reporting at the edge of science and reality. Credible, cutting edge, and new stories every single day. And then there's our free newsletter. Sign up on unknowncountry.com. Our list is private. You will not receive spam, just our great newsletter every single week. Plus, our lively message boards are fun, informative, and challenging. The best gathering spot of its kind on the internet, and the biggest. Click on the message boards link on unknowncountry.com to join. And of course, Dreamland and Revelations, free every week. Want to help support our work? Become a subscriber or just give us a donation. Every little bit helps keep this important community going.
This is Whitley Strieber. The beautiful new 2014 Crop Circle Calendar is in the unknowncountry.com store. The calendar retails for $22.95. If you're an unknowncountry.com subscriber, it's $19.95. And while supplies last, purchasers will receive a 2013 Crop Circle calendar as well. Make your collection complete. Get a 2014 Crop Circle calendar, and as long as we have supplies, a 2013 calendar as well. This year's calendar is just beautiful, inspirational. The calendars are made up of special crop circle images found by Lucy Pringle over the past few years, and these are particularly beautiful. The crop circles and crop formations grow more powerful, more sophisticated, and more beautiful every day. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the tab on the right for the calendar. We're talking to Dr. Robert Wood and Nick Redfern about their, quite frankly, incredibly important book, Alien Viruses, Crashed UFOs, MJ-12, and Biowarfare. These men are experts of the first order, and they are talking about things that are so incredible that it's almost outside of reality, and yet it's real. Their websites, MajesticDocuments.com. Every document we talk about you can find on MajesticDocuments.com, including the one, the SOM-1-01 document that we are talking about, have been talking about right now. Nick Redfern's always fascinating website is Nick Redfern Fortean, F-O-R-T-E-A-N. That's NickRedfernFortean.blogspot.com. Before we left the air, Bob, you mentioned that the reason that this was so well developed in the early 50s is that there had actually been crashes earlier on, before 1947, before the Roswell incident. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the most well-known one is the Los Angeles air raid case, where 1,430 rounds of ammunition were fired on February 24th, 1942. And then on the 25th, why they announced the fact that it happened, and that was an unclassified document. But what happened after that was a week later, General Marshall wrote a letter to FDR stating that we recovered one craft from the San Bernardino Mountains and the Navy salvaged one at sea. And this was on a memo that has stamped on the top, Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, which it turns out is the same name as on a document from 1947 with the Roswell crash. And so the original recovered crafts in 1942 were, in my opinion, the trigger that caused us to develop a logical plan to ensure that we got the craft, we were able to study them, reverse engineer them, and keep the public in the dark. And there were other documents that were very significant. Franklin Roosevelt wrote one called Double Top Secret, where he was writing to the Special Committee on Non-Terrestrial Committee, telling them that no, they couldn't have any money to study this problem until we beat the Nazis. And then later on, Vannevar Bush had to tell Harry Truman what all had gone on with respect to these craft. So that's why, in my opinion, we had such a very sophisticated process at work in 1947 when the Roswell crash occurred, and then it's what's reflected in the 1954 Special Operations Manual.
Yeah, of course, because the Special Operations Manual is very developed. You know, I was sent a copy of it and about that same time, and it arrived at my mail center in Texas. It wasn't a microfilm, and this is a sad story, and I hate to tell it. It was a rather old-feeling paper document, but unfortunately, at the time, I did not realize its significance. And I didn't know anyone, I knew Stanton, but not very well, who was involved in it. And we eventually tossed it without realizing what we had. And it may have been that it was just something that somebody sent us who had had a copy of it. But if so, it would have been one of you. And you
wouldn't. Well, Berliner sent a fax to Stan Friedman, and Stan sent me the fax. So it might have been the same original fax.
It wasn't a fax. It was this was a printed document.
Oh.
In an envelope.
Oh.
And I'm very sorry to say this, but it's true. But in any case, I at least held in my hands at one point what appeared to be an original version of this document.
Well, actually, Ryan and I printed 1,500 replicas of this document.
Oh, maybe it was one of those.
It was one of those. Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. I've always worried about that because I thought, you know, I've tried so hard with this thing, and if I missed on something like that, I would be heartbroken. Anyway, I'm very glad to hear that. Now, let's go on. The chapter 12 of your guy's book, Crashed UFOs, Biowar, and the JFK Assassination, 1961-1963. This, I dropped my teeth. I have to tell you, we've talked about this on Dreamland before, but not in depth. And it's time to really talk about it in depth. One of the areas of controversy surrounding both MJ-12 and crashed UFOs that is seldom discussed, you say, in a serious forum is that which posits a link between those same issues and the assassination of United States President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963. Tell us, then, I don't know who wants to lead with this. You guys, either one of you who is most comfortable with this, I think this might be your bailiwick, Bob, if I'm not correct. But, Nick,
I'd like to begin with a brief, with a brief link that goes right to the 1947 Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit 7 pages that we got that were leaked. The bottom of the third page, it says, it has become known to CIC that some of the recovery operation was shared with Representative John F. Kennedy, Massachusetts Democrat, elected to Congress in 1946. And so that's really quite remarkable. This 1947 document states that JFK was exposed to some of the recovery operation, which is really never been discussed widely.
So way back in the 40s.
Yeah.
When he was a young man.
Yeah, right.
Why? Do you know? Does it any idea? Because he was a young senator then, is that correct?
Well, it goes on to say he was a son of Joseph P. Kennedy, commissioner of an organization of the executive branch of the government. Kennedy had limited duty as a naval officer assigned to naval intelligence during the war. It is believed that information was obtained from source in Congress who was close to Secretary for Air Force. That's what the document says, and that's all the clues we have. But Kennedy, clearly, if he knew about recovery of a crashed saucer in 1947, would never have forgotten that, and would have, I would think, always have been trying to learn as much as he could. And there are two memos that he wrote, you know, just 10 days before he was assassinated. One was to NASA, telling him he wanted to cooperate with USSR on outer space matters, and the other was to Angleton, the CIA counterintelligence director, telling him he wanted to review all the UFO intelligence files and share data with NASA where there were unknowns, namely UFOs.
It certainly wasn't generally known that James Angleton was involved in this subject. He was known as the head of the Soviet Russia division, and that was historically, that's what's known about him. But I was told by General Arthur Exon in 1988 or 89, the former commandant of Wright Patt, who was the source of my book, most of the source of my book, Majestic, on the Roswell incident, my novel on the Roswell incident. I say novel in quotes for the most part. In any case, General Exon said that Angleton was involved, and in my book I disguised him and called the character in the book who's based on Angleton a man who was obsessed with fishing. He was a fly fisherman. And which Angleton was, too, in any case. So we know that Angleton was involved, but go ahead.
Well, the thing about the second memo is that in handwriting at the bottom, it says, response from Colby, Angleton has MJ directive, and then it's 11/20/63. So this was just 2 days before he was assassinated. We have a handwritten statement that Angleton has an MJ directive. So this is pretty high confirmation.
Yeah, and the handwritten document has been handwriting's been analyzed.
Well, no, I don't know who to
try. Oh, I see. Of course, yeah, I understand.
I heard a rumor that it might have been the police chief of Dallas, but I haven't explored that.
Yeah, I see.
Detail.
Okay, but go ahead now. Let's go on with this connection.
Well, one of the things that Nick did, he looked into the associations with people who were involved in the JFK testimony, and maybe Nick, you could pick up on those five or six people who had links to crashed UFOs.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, this is an area that's sort of very much underappreciated, I think, Whitley, in the sense that, I mean, I've literally got piles of material, like 2 or 3 feet high, literally, of documentation that makes a link between UFOs and the Kennedy assassination. The material in the book is just one chapter, but I mean, there's a book's worth of material already in hand. One of the most fascinating things that probably a lot of people won't be aware of, and this is really, really intriguing, is that on the day before Kennedy was shot, November the 21st, he paid a visit to Brooks Air Force Base in Texas. And while he was at Brooks, he was there to basically dedicate 6 new aerospace medical research buildings that were being opened. And so it's like a very prestigious opening, etc. Now, what's more interesting is that while he was there, Kennedy actually had a couple of behind-closed-doors meetings with a number of significant individuals. One of these was a man named Major General Theodore Bedwell. And it turns out that Bedwell was actually the deputy surgeon at Wright-Patterson in the summer of 1947 when, you know, we're told that all the material from Roswell was sent to Wright-Patterson. He also, Kennedy also had a meeting while at Brooks with a man named Colonel Harold Ellingson of the U.S. Air Force, who had a Bachelor of Science degree in bacteriology. And he was also the post-surgeon and hospital commander at Fort Detrick, Maryland, which has been linked with alien virus research. So in other words, just 24 hours before he was shot, actually less than 24 hours, Kennedy had met two people, both with medical backgrounds, one from Wright-Patt, one from Fort Detrick, at an Air Force base, which has been linked over the years, Brooks Air Force Base, with various aspects of ufology. And for me, that is one of the more sort of intriguing connections and themes linking the Kennedy assassination and UFOs.
So he was linked, and there's an even deeper, weirder link between the Kennedy assassination and some people who were involved in an earlier UFO incident, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, one of the classic ones, a person who's very often linked as one of these sort of conspirators, is a man named Guy Bannister. And Guy Bannister was a former FBI agent. If you've seen the movie JFK, he's played by Ed Asner in the film. But Bannister, as I said, former FBI agent, and when he retired, he moved to New Orleans and set up his own detective agency called Guy Bannister Associates. And he's been linked with all sorts of players in the Kennedy assassination, like Oswald, David Ferry, and various other players as well, suggesting he's part of some kind of cabal, if you like, and that his intelligence work was sort of continued afterwards on an off-the-record basis. And, you know, he was brought in when tricky situations needed resolving, like the Kennedy assassination. What's interesting, though, is that in 1947, Bannister was heavily involved in investigating UFO reports for the FBI. Many of the reports that Bannister filed are actually now freely available through the Freedom of Information Act in the collections of documents that the FBI have released. And on top of that, Bannister was also involved in investigating in the late 40s and early 50s strange deaths in the U.S. cattle herd. And again, that's officially recorded. So they're not described as cattle mutilations, but they're talked about suspicious deaths as if, you know, the cattle had been targeted by some mysterious entity, if you like. So,
yeah, and last week on Dreamland, we were talking to Linda Moulton Howe about suspicious cattle deaths that happened in the past month. So it still goes on.
Yeah, so here you have a man tied to the Kennedy assassination, tied to animal deaths, and also undertaking summer 1947 UFO investigations for the FBI. And, I mean, the list, you know, the list literally sort of goes on and on. For example,
on and on.
I mean, Dorothy Kilgallen,
well,
the famous
gentleman, we have come
journalist
to
of the 1950s, she, in 1955, was given a story of a crashed UFO incident, and she actually followed this subject quite deeply. She was actually also the very last person to interview Jack Ruby, the man who shot Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes.
So, you know, you have another connection there, and they really go on.
But
there's a... And ties.
I've studied the Dorothy Kilgallen situation very carefully for various personal reasons. She brought a manuscript back with her on the plane from Dallas and gave it to a friend who, for safekeeping, because she didn't have apparently didn't make copies. I mean, this is long before Xerox machines or anything, and she died that just shortly thereafter, I think that same night, under mysterious circumstances. Her husband always maintained that she didn't take barbiturates, and she died of alcohol poisoning and an overdose of barbiturates, and making it look like the accidental death of someone dissolute. But here's the manuscript issue. The manuscript was given to a friend who died a couple of days later under equally mysterious circumstances, and the manuscript has never been found. So,
well, yeah, I mean, this is another interesting angle. You know, the number of deaths, weird deaths associated with the assassination too. You know, people just falling like flies. If it was one or two, well, you know, it's just one or two, but it actually isn't. You know, potentially we're talking dozens. I mean, not a death related, but another intriguing one is that Senator Richard Russell, who was one of the members of the so-called Warren Commission, he had a major UFO sighting in 1955 when visiting Russia, the former Soviet Union at the time, and he was debriefed by the CIA on this particular encounter. Russell was one of the, actually the only member of the Warren Commission who thought that a conspiracy lay behind Kennedy's death, and not only that, Colonel Philip Corso was actually an investigator for Senator Richard Russell. He did some work for him when Russell was involved with the Warren Commission. So, you know, you've got another tie-in there that sort of backtracks to Corso even.
And we have a book coming out in a couple of weeks now, I think just before the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, from the Atlantic Monthly Press by a New York Times reporter, saying that members of the Warren Commission are now saying that it was a cover-up and that powerful forces were involved in forcing them to draw the conclusions they did about the assassination. So, we're going to take a break, folks, and we're going to extend Dreamland a little bit this week because we usually go half an hour. We're going to go 45 minutes because I can't stop. They can't stop. No one wants to stop. This is quite incredible. Then for subscribers, we're getting down deeper because a lot of you subscribers are close encounter witnesses also and are people who are intensely curious about this. And we're going to be talking about diseases and viruses associated with close contact. We'll be right back.
He's a detective. Good at it. Dedicated. Then his wife disappears. It looks like she left on her own, but he can't believe it. He searches and searches. He looks so long and so hard that he's finally contacted by the head of the world's most secret police force, and Detective Flynn Carroll becomes an alien hunter. This very special police unit, drawn from among the best of the best, works in cooperation with a police force from another planet to hunt down alien criminals on Earth. Searingly powerful. So close to the truth that it whispers real. First in Whitley Strieber's new Flynn Carroll Alien Hunter series. On sale now. Get your copy today.
Plus, go to alienhunterbook.com and download the free illustrated PDF sampler. It's way cool. That's alienhunterbook.com.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. This is the Edge of the World.
Some of the most thrilling, mind-opening interviews ever recorded are in the Dreamland Archive. Open your mind to Sir Lawrence Gardner's brilliant vision of the past. Listen to Russell Targ's phenomenal insights about ESP. Be inspired by Dr. Eben Alexander's stunning near-death experience. Listen to an actual recording from a plane as it was attacked by a gigantic flying disc. Be transported to a new level of inner grace with Whitley Strieber's meditations. Enjoy The Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Secret School, and Superstorm audiobooks, and so much more. The UnknownCountry.com subscriber section. $3.95 a month to $79 for 2 years. as little as 10 cents a day. Priceless.
This is Whitley Strieber. Go to unknowncountry.com today and start your subscription. You owe it to yourself. Folks, we're back. We're talking to Dr. Robert Wood and Nick Redfern about their incredible book, Alien Viruses, Crashed UFOs, MJ-12, and Biowarfare. If, you know, you gotta get this simply because it is unputdownable reading. It's fabulous. And as you can hear these men, this is serious stuff. These are expert researchers working way out at the edge where nothing is supposed to be real. And everything is real. It's damn real. It's real. Their websites, majesticdocuments.com and nickredfernfortean, FORTEAN.blogspot.com. Keep up with their work, and above all, get this and read it. It's going to open your mind. Maybe it's going to open your mind to your own experiences. Now, gentlemen, I would like to go on and talk about another character who is involved both in the Maury Island UFO incident and in was also involved apparently in the Kennedy assassination, and that is Fred Chrisman. Either one of you. I don't know who's going to lead with these stories, so you just start talking, whichever one knows the most about this, if you know.
Okay. Do you want me to do that, Bob?
I think you should, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, Chrisman was a very interesting and very shady and almost like sinister type person. He was involved, we know that in the Second World War and the post-Second World War era, he was involved in intelligence matters. And lo and behold, when the whole UFO issue kicked off in the summer of 47, he was also linked to one of the most notorious cases of all time, the so-called Maury Island event, where a number of UFOs were seen reportedly hovering over Tacoma, in the particular harbor area of Tacoma in Washington State, and reportedly one of these craft malfunctioned and exploded and showered the harbor with all this strange debris and materials that a man named Harold Dahl reportedly recovered some of it. And apparently his superior in the area working on the in the harbor area was, of all people, Fred Chrisman. And he handed over some of this weird wreckage to Chrisman, which was described as being very lightweight and foil-like. And Chrisman then got involved in the investigation, and actually Kenneth Arnold came out as well, because Ray Palmer of Amazing Stories magazine hired Arnold to investigate it for him.
Kenneth Arnold, folks, is the person who originally observed UFOs in 1947 near Mount Rainier from his airplane. But go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And so you had Harold Dahl, the man who found the material, you had Chrisman hovering around, and you had Arnold there as well. And a number of U.S. Air Force investigators were flown in to actually bring some of this wreckage back for study. And they took the wreckage on board the plane, barely got into the sky when the aircraft exploded, killing those two guys and a couple of the other guys on board the plane, although not all of them. And the wreckage from this device, whatever it was that exploded over the harbor, was never recovered, at least not officially. So we have Chrisman in this case, which ended in tragedy and death and vanished wreckage, etc. That wasn't enough. 20 years later, in the Kennedy assassination, Jim Garrison, portrayed by Kevin Costner in JFK, New Orleans district attorney, he began looking into the Kennedy assassination and found links between Chrisman and the aforementioned Guy Bannister, David Ferry, and Lee Harvey Oswald. And one of the areas that was actually looked at was the idea that Chrisman was one of the so-called three hobos arrested at the site of the assassination. One of the theories is that, you know, they weren't actually hobos, but they were assassins in disguise. And a number of people have suggested that Chrisman was one of these men. So, again, you have this man who was involved in the early formative years of ufology, one of which involved sort of tragedy and death under mysterious circumstances. Then he pops up 20 years later in arguably the world's second biggest conspiracy, the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, he seemed to have a finger in so many intelligence-related pies, so to speak, and he moved effortlessly, you know, through the military and underworld, if you like, and very, very strange and enigmatic character. And a lot of people got this sort of weird, like an unsettling vibe, you know, when he was with them. He kind of just kind of upset their sort of mindset, if you like.
Back in 2005, folks, we did an interview about a book called Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. And it was fascinating stuff. It figures in this. Could you tell us a little bit about Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus and what was found there?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a book written by Ed Haslam, and this gets to the heart of a lot of this. Again, David Ferry, who was one of the alleged conspirators in the Kennedy assassination, and again, just to go back to
alleged
the JFK
by Jim Garrison.
Yes, right.
Who probably
just
was
go back to the JFK film.
Right.
He was, you know, he was portrayed in the movie, and so he used to wear this weird-looking wig, and, you know, he's a very strange-looking character. But Ferry was obsessed with finding cures for cancer, and in his apartment he had sort of cages full of rats and mice, and he would do all sorts of bizarre experiments on them. And the story really of Mary Ferry and the monkey virus relates to experiments undertaken on monkeys to try and sort of create biological viruses. The idea that, you know, certain monkeys were infected by something that some researchers think may have been the AIDS virus in like an early incarnation, but decades ago and long before it erupted, you know, on a large scale, and that some of these monkeys may well have been sort of tampered with, and these viruses genetically altered to try and create sort of the ultimate bioweapon.
Coming out of,
reportedly involved in all this.
And we have an interview, folks. It's from May the 7th, 2005. Oh. And subscribers, just either you can simply enter the word Ferry, F-E-R-R-I-E, into the search engine, and you can listen to this interview. Jim Mars interviewing Ed Haslam. Of course, Jim Mars, the great, the source of the movie JFK, and one of the authors of one of the great books on JFK. It's fabulous, a wonderful interview, and don't miss it. Now, let's go on, if I may. We have a few minutes left on this extended version of Dreamland, and what are your conclusions about JFK and the assassination of JFK? Was he assassinated at least in part because he was about to spill the beans about UFOs?
Well, I think that is a correct statement. If you leave the word in part there were so many different people who had so many reasons that I think it would be unfair to claim that the sole motivation for getting rid of him was the UFO issue. However, it is true. One of the things that clearly identifies him with this at the highest level was an intercepted conversation that he had with Nikita Khrushchev on this very topic. They agreed that UFOs were a problem for both of them, and they should work in more harmony. And that agreement was what triggered JFK to write these two memos that I alluded to earlier on the 12th of November.
Now, why would we believe that this discussion, which is mentioned on page 152 and 153 of Alien Viruses, actually happened? Can you give us the authentication of that, if you will, please?
Well, it's one of the memos that came from Timothy Cooper. We have 4,000 pages of material that came from Timothy.
And it was given to him by whom?
From 8 different sources, actually. One guy show up, and clearly he was dumping the contents of his file. He had arms full of papers, many of which were not classified. They were just military documents. And many of them were mailed. One was mailed from Fort Meade. And I've seen the actual envelopes that they came in. So it's clear to me that somebody who was mailing documents to Timothy, he didn't invent anything himself. They clearly came in the mail.
Why would they be mailed to Timothy in particular?
Well, the simple history of that is that his father was a photographer who was apparently asked to run copies of a crashed UFO retrieval process. And I think the people that his father knew in counterintelligence were the ones who knew that his son, Timothy, was interested in the subject because he had actually told his father's story to Leonard Stringfield, and Leonard published it in a book. And so, in my opinion, they felt that if they're going to find a good source to leak this material to the world, that Timothy Cooper was maybe a credible source.
And it's the same reason that General Exum talked to me, because my uncle was involved and they knew of my interest in this. Yeah, I see the same motivation there. Did Timothy not have some knowledge of printing and so on and so forth?
No, not really. No. His main focus, he was really studying the JFK assassination.
I see.
And that was his focus, and all of a sudden he started to get these this mail from people he didn't know. One of them was Cantwheel, who probably wasn't his real name, it was Cantwell maybe, but anyway, he said he was about to die and he was going to be sending him lots of information. And after that, the flood started to come in the form of various envelopes in the mail.
And like so many of them, and we hear this again and again on Dreamland, he was about to die. In other words, these are people who are giving up this information when they are very old because they don't want to die with a lie on their conscience.
I think so.
This is probably true. Certainly Colonel Marcel, Colonel Jesse Marcel, the first one I know of to do this, has been followed by many others, including, I think, Phil Corso, who wasn't expecting to die, but he was getting on in years. Now, folks, we have reached the end of our extended Dreamland. For you subscribers, when we get back in the subscriber area, we're going to be talking about the virus connection and the illness connection with this, which is very profound, disturbing, and fascinating material. And if you're interested in this, in just in passing, you're listening to Free Dreamland, I urge you to get deeper into this, because in fact everything we talk about on this program is scorned and denied by the general media because they are professional liars. We are talking to professional researchers who are telling the truth. Most people aren't interested in the truth. Most people love the lie. You've come this far with this program because you don't love the lie. You are interested in the truth. I urge you, subscribe and keep going. This has been Dreamland. We've been talking to Dr. Robert Wood and Nick Redfern. Their book, Alien Viruses, Crashed UFOs, MJ-12, and Bio Warfare. Get it. Thank you both gentlemen very much for being with us on Dreamland.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and our family of subscribers. Our news editor is Ann Streber. Our science reporter is Linda Moulton Howe. Our webmaster is Daniel Stiegel. And I'm your Dreamland announcer, Brian Arnold. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.